And this morning we have three bills for public hearing and possible work session. The first one is House Bill 3615 relating to the Public Utility Commission. Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I have distributed for you a staff measure summary from the Substantive Committee, the Health Committee on Commerce, and also a fiscal impact statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office. And House Bill 3615 would expand the number of commissioners for the Public Utility Commission from 3 to 5. It would also transfer the PUC office and staff to the Department of Consumer and Business Services and make the director of DCBS responsible for the supervision and control of PUC. Just briefly, I'll go over the fiscal impact and increase the number of commissioners from 3 to 5. The Public Utility Commission estimates an additional $477,298 in other funds for salaries and other related expenses for the two new commissioners. And the personal services portion of that would be $357,298, services and supplies $90,000, and then $30,000 for one-time expenses such as remodeling, adding new offices for the new commissioners, revising letterhead, and so on.
Could I ask you on your figures there? These are figures that the PUC has provided.
That's correct.
Where is the cost savings lowering down from full-time to part-time? Where does it show up? And all we're seeing here is additional funding rather than less funding. Where's the less funding now?
Mr. Chair, the way that the bill is currently worded, it doesn't indicate that the commissioners would be part-time, so the assumption is that that they would be full-time.
5 full-time
commissioners, that's correct.
Okay. Dr. Dunbar?
Mr. Chair, if I can address that. I did meet with a member of the PUC staff and asked what the recommendation would be. Where the bill is silent, and it's my understanding that Representative Hill has asked for an introduction of an amendment to the bill relative to these would be lay commissioners, 5 lay commissioners as opposed to 5 full-time commissioners. When the staff person from PUC shared with me the information showing the rather substantial fiscal impact by adding 2 full-time paid commissioners, I asked for the information to find out what it would be to what the savings would be to have those commissioners move to the lay commissioners, similar to the Department of Transportation or other business entities that state operates that have lay commissioners. I never received anything back from the PUC to give me the correct amount of what that would be, what the per diem cost would be to be actually moved under the DCBS. But my understanding is that there are amendments being presented which would actually clarify the fact that these were meant to be lay commissioners as opposed to paid commissioners, and current staff are capable. There's specialists over the energy, dealing with electrical energy, dealing with natural gas, and there's a specialist over the telecommunications right now, all of whom are capable of handling and operating those fields under the direction of Director Greenfield from the DCBS.
Okay. Are there any questions? Would you like to make any presentation, or would like your presentation on 3615?
Well, I could certainly make a presentation, Mr. Chair, but that presentation would be that the intent of 3615, House Bill 3615, was not in any way to make 2 additional full-time paid staff people. And again, when the PUC gave the amounts of these additional $477,000, I asked for a revised fiscal impact to bring those as lay parties only, so they would be being paid the per diem, and I received absolutely no cooperation from PUC. They failed, they refused, and they continue to refuse to cooperate with the concept that they have staff on board that are capable of handling those particular three areas dealing with the regulation of electrical energy and natural gas and the telecommunications. They have those people presently on staff that are capable of staffing those departments and heading those departments under the direction of a paid manager and the person of Mike Greenfield, the current director of the DCDS, and that the commissioners, all three or all five of the commissioners, the three that are there presently being paid for full time and the two additional, would all go to strictly lay commissioner work and would be paid on the basis of the work that they, the meetings that they attend and the out-of-pocket costs that they incur. And again, as I stated at first, that was what I requested of the PUC, and they have not only failed to provide the information, they have refused to cooperate and provide the information as to the savings that there could be generated to the state of Oregon in making a more efficient Public Utilities Commission through lay commissioners with the existing staff and Mr. Greenfield at the helm.
Yes, Representative Beth.
Can I ask the question, I guess, for... Is this your...
Yes.
What's the problem that we're... this gap that we went from a one-person commission in the late 80s, and we had a ballot measure to make it a three-person commission. I guess there were problems when we had one commissioner making decisions. But what's, and maybe someone will testify to some of the history of CUC and why there was a lot of support that came to me at that time to go to an expanded commission. But what problem is this solving? What's the existing problem and how will this solve it in your mind?
Representative Hill is the co-sponsor of House Bill 3615 with me, and Representative Hill has been working directly with the PUC on a number of related issues relative to matters dealing with the operation of the PUC and the efficiency. There are some benefits to having folks as actual specialized people that can run the various departments and answering to a statewide group of commissioners that are appointed by the governor. And at that particular point, much like Director Prenican that we've been working with through the ODOT, would be chosen by the governor or the commissioners themselves, depending upon what the citizens decide in that regard. In this regard, the efficiencies would be that you would have folks that were appointed by the governor who maybe knew very little about PUC issues that come in and are receiving rather substantial compensations, and it appears to be a political reward as opposed to a commissionership where they actually are a lay commission and give direction as opposed to dictating exactly what will happen in the department. Again, Mr. Greenfield, or the current head of the DCDS, which is a business and consumer service-oriented program, very naturally fits into the field as we move towards some type of deregulation, as we move towards the more economic, the economies dealing with the internet and cyberspace issues that we'll be dealing with and the overall issues relative to the Public Utilities Commission, and these folks that are specialized should be in charge of those areas as opposed to just governor appointees that have the total responsibility of managing the day-to-day affairs of a commission, which is responsible for, really, this is a basic staple of life between electrical and energy and communication. It becomes a basic staple of life and becomes very important from that standpoint. Thus, a lay citizens committee of commissioners should be very vital to us, using specialists within the department to run each of the three areas.
Representative Scar.
Thank you. Representative Butler, is there further amendments planned for this bill?
Yes, my understanding is that Representative Hill has an amendment that is already in LC relative to making sure that it is absolutely understood correctly that these were not contemplated to be paid positions, and has some other minor modifications, which leaves it leaves a net positive effect on the state's funds that are available in the other funds coming through the PUC.
Okay. Senator Duke.
Has this bill been through a substantive
committee? Yes.
And
it referred down here because the fifth
floor passed. And nobody thought that it was not really the full time?
No, the bill is silent as to the full time versus Mr. Chair.
There must have been a memory in the substantive committee if they didn't know this. Was the fiscal available then? That must be how, I assume the fiscal is how it got here. And did the substantive committee like 5 full time members, or did they not notice?
I don't know. I wasn't on the substantive committee of the House, though. We'll go ahead and open it up to testimony. Bob Jinks, Portland, and John Glasscock. If you both want to come up, please. You can identify yourselves for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB is a statewide organization created to represent the interests of residential utility customers. CUB is funded and supported directly by ratepayers, and we have members in every legislative district in Oregon. We're here today to urge you to reject House Bill 3615. We think it's terrible public policy. We think it overturns the ballot measure 4 from 1986. With respect to what happened in the substantive committee, this had a hearing, a public hearing and work session, all within about 5 minutes that was gaveled through, and there wasn't an opportunity for us to present testimony at that point and to express our deep concern with this bill. And we also understand that the intent was to make this bill a volunteer commission. We think the goal of that is to fire the current 3 commissioners who obviously need a job, and if they don't have a full-time job anymore, we'll have to seek other employment and replace them with a volunteer commission that doesn't have experience or expertise. That, we believe, is the real intention of the goal. Whether you believe in regulation or you believe in deregulation, this is a terrible idea. The commission would not have the expertise or ability to regulate as current Oregon law requires. Neither would the commission have the expertise or ability to implement the series of decisions necessary to transition our utilities from the current system to a deregulated system as contemplated by Senate Bill 142 or Senate Bill 1149. Secondly, we believe this does overturn ballot measure 4 from 1986. I was somebody who worked in the campaign in support of that ballot measure, and that ballot measure was to create a full-time 3-person PUC. It passed by more than 400,000 votes, by more than a 2-to-1 margin. Attached to my testimony, I put a cartoon that was used during that campaign, and I wanted to do that because that cartoon shows that the goal of ballot measure 4 from 1986 was to strengthen the PUC. It was designed to give Oregon a stronger utility watchdog. House Bill 3615 is designed to do exactly the opposite. It is designed to neuter the state's utility watchdog. When ballot measure 4 passed in 1986, it was a compromise. Many consumer advocates, myself included, believe that Oregon should elect their commissioners. I did a study of electric rates around the country and found that the way rates are divided between residential customers and industrial customers tended to be much more in residential customers' favor in states that elect the commissioners directly. And we still believe that that's a good idea. The utilities have always opposed that idea. The legislature referred ballot measure 4 to the ballot in 86 with the express agreement from consumer advocates with Cobb, Oxford, United Seniors that we would not run a ballot measure to make to change to an elected commission. We've agreed to do that, and in the 10 years, or more than 10 years since that period, we have not run such a ballot measure. We have not tried to change the system to an elected system. So I have to say, every time the PUC raises rates, I get phone calls from people who are saying, shouldn't we change to an elected commission? Isn't it time to do that ballot measure now? There's still a group of activists there that would like to change our utility system to an elected PUC. House Bill 3615 reneges on the agreement, and I believe is likely to lead ultimately to such an initiative. Finally, we think that House Bill 3615 misreads the mood of the public. In Oregon, we continue to have service quality problems with our largest telephone companies. Three of the four largest utilities in the state are currently undergoing mergers, and the fourth recently underwent a merger. Both the telecommunications industry and the electric industry are in a state of transition that could have significant effects, both positive and negative, on every business and every household in the state. I believe that Oregonians understand the need for the PUC and would be shocked if they knew that the legislature was attempting to destroy its ability to protect consumers. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? No, thank you. John Glasscock, Portland.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Glasscock, and I represent at least 430,000 members of AARP in Oregon, all of whom are very concerned about this bill because it appears to weaken the protections that they now enjoy under the present PUC. We oppose this bill because we don't feel it's in the public interest, and it disagrees with what most Oregonians and your constituents want. They expressed themselves in 1986 by voting 724,577 to 297,972.61 to 29% to strengthen the Public Utilities Commission by increasing from a one-member to a three-member commission. And as my colleague has indicated, the cartoons certainly expresses the desire of the public at that time. Over the years, and I've attended dozens and dozens of hearings at the Public Utilities Commission, these are open, fair hearings. Anybody who wants to speak to the subject can speak to it. Unlike some of the committees here in the legislature, we've had an opportunity to express ourselves. This three-person commission has, through fair, open, and public hearings involving all the stakeholders, met its statutory obligation to assure just and reasonable rates for hundreds of thousands of Oregonians and a fair rate of return for the companies. I've never heard, and I doubt if anybody could say, that any company regulated by our present PUC has ever expressed a concern about their a fair rate of return. AARP believes that House Bill 3615 should be defeated for the following reasons. First of all, we think that this bill is a solution looking for a problem. It fails to recognize the statutory goals of the PUC and dumps the agency and another agency whose primary responsibility relates to competitive industries such as insurance and banking. It's out of touch with most Oregonians who rely on the PUC and support its efforts to protect the public interest in a fair, balanced manner, while at the same time assuring companies a fair rate of return. Second, the notion that developing utilities competition requires changes suggests House Bill 3615 has no validity whatsoever. It ignores the complexity of utility issues and the utility marketplace. It is not like buying a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk. Instead, it involves a complex, rapidly developing technology and a predatory high-tech market that can have serious consequences for hundreds of thousands of utility end users without an appropriate balance between competition and regulation, as specified in our present statutes, especially in the telecommunications arena. At this time, only 0.9% of Oregonians' customers have a choice with respect to their their local telephone exchange, hardly real competition. And this is 3 years after the Federal Telecommunications Act was passed, which was designed to promote competition, and also which was designed to ensure not just and reasonable, but affordable rates for everyone. The restructuring of electric cars will continue to require significant PUC expertise to carry out its complexities. By third, House Bill 3615, by moving the PUC under the Department of Business and Consumer Services, signals that your constituents and the public interest are not very important. We even understand there will be an attempt, as was expressed by Representative Butler, to further reduce its expertise by making commissioners only part-time, thus further reducing their ability to act in the public interest. House Bill 3615 appears to be nothing more than less than a power move to reduce the effectiveness of PUC in protecting the public interest. Finally, House Bill 3615 seeks to politicize the operation of PUC, the very thing that voters decided in Measure 4 in 1986 to abolish. It appears that the sponsors of this bill do not like the open, fair, public process the PUC has for conducting utility business. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Betts?
Mr. Blackcott, is that the right name?
Yes.
Were you able to testify before the substantive committee on this?
No.
How would you characterize the conversation before the committee? Was it lengthy, or did you sign up to testify, or?
There was not an opportunity to testify.
Did you know of the hearing?
I knew of the hearing.
And there was just?
It was just a tap, what I call a tap hearing. We see many of them these days.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Butler.
I'd just like to ask Mr. Glasgow, do you feel like anything may have changed in the last 13 years with regard to any of these utilities?
Yes, it's become even more complex, and the need for protecting public interest is even greater than ever.
Follow up?
Yes.
He indicated that he felt like that no one has come forward to indicate any problems with the current system that we have. I just wondered if Mr. Glasscock had been here or had talked to anyone who had been here as we had hearings with the PUC earlier and before the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, first I answer your first question. My statement, I believe, reflected we were unaware of any criticism by utilities that their rates weren't fair. That was my statement, I believe. And with respect to other hearings, yes, I have heard comments about the PUC. I think they're unwarranted. I think they reflect an anger that is not based on facts.
Mr. Chair, so that I could just give Mr. Glasscock some feel for what happened. The room was noticeably devoid of anyone from the private industry as the PUC gave testimony, primarily as a result of concerns about retribution. And that does not foster the kinds of concerns or the kinds of open dialogue that would be necessary in order to come back and take a look at what the ballot measure for from 14 years ago would have accomplished for us.
Mr. Chair, that's a pretty serious accusation. Do you have anything substantive to back that up?
Because I was the one that made this statement.
That the private utilities weren't there for fear of retribution?
They would not issue any negative comments. I asked them to consider coming forth and telling us what their concerns were. Their response was they didn't need the heavy-handed approach if they said something to conduct business. And so I made the statement then that a representative was quoting myself that appeared in Oregonian. So I have first-hand knowledge, not gossip or second-hand, first-hand knowledge. Further questions or comments?
Just comment, Mr. Chair. I also have first-hand comment or first-hand knowledge that the leaders of private industry dealing with the regulation or dealing with utilities of this state will not appear in the same room in this kind of forum and format for fear of retribution by members of the three-man utility board. The Public Utility Commission, who are paid and are paid handsomely to control this monopoly.
Representative Beck, well, I'd be curious to hear from Mr. Wrighton or Mr. Ineson or the chair at CPNL is, or Civic Corps. I'd be curious to hear whether these Mr. Miller, PGE, or I would be curious to hear whether some of these people feel that strongly.
Well, we're not talking about CEOs or executive financial officers or anybody else. We're talking about the mainstream employees who work day in and day out with the legislature and the regulatory agencies. And that's their comment that they can't officially say it on the record because they've been instructed otherwise. By your Mr. Fred Miller, by your Mr. Dick Wrighton, and by others.
Do they want to invite them to your office for private conversations? And I would encourage you to do that, seriously.
Okay, further questions? No, thank you very much. This is not going to be a tab hearing, but we will offer the opportunity to represent Jim Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Jim Hill. To address the issue in terms of the hearing in the Commerce Committee, as we all know, we have deadlines. We had to meet deadlines. And so the process was at hand. The bill was introduced by Representative Butler and myself later in the process, and so we moved it down to Ways and Means. And the opportunity for a venue to discuss the issues at hand is here, and everyone can discuss that. There was not an attempt to squelch debate on the issue. Committee members knew exactly what was going to happen and that there would be opportunity for people to debate the issue. I would disagree with Mr. Glasscock regarding some of his comments in terms of there is concern by utility companies in terms of the rate of return that the Commission has allowed. I think in terms of, if you can go look at what has occurred with Northwest Natural Gas in terms of their publicly held company, they've been placed on credit watch, the company, their financial future is at risk, and the ability for them to deliver service to Oregon is at risk in terms of because of the rate of return that the Commission has established for them. The Commission denied the ability for Northwest Natural Gas to recover in rate and investment for a pipeline to Tuesday in terms of that would have benefited all of Oregonians, I think, in the long run. And so as a result of that, this legislative body has before it the responsibility to look at investing $20 million to help finance a pipeline project to Tuesday for an economic development. I think in terms of the Commission has, I think, swung too far in terms of their interest, and they're not taking an active role in understanding that as Oregonians, we need to have a healthy infrastructure, a healthy electrical distribution system, a healthy gas distribution system and healthy telecommunications infrastructure that will support economic development. And in our present structure, the company need to come to the, before the commission and get a reasonable return on those dollars so that they can go to the market, they can get the necessary capital to make those investments. This is not free. This is not to suggest that that this is any way going to be detrimental to consumers, to inhibit their ability for fair and reasonable rates. But I think in terms of we all represent different districts and different areas of the state that have a financial we risk our ability as a state to effectively deal with economic growth in our economic future. And so I think it's very important that we understand in a holistic approach in terms of the role of the PUC. The PUC is not simply there to protect consumers. That is one of their roles. Their other role is to make sure that we have a healthy utility system so that that all Oregonians can benefit from the fact that we have electricity that is delivered safely and effectively and efficiently. We have gas system, which is distributing gas. We have a telephone system that you pick up the phone and that you can get there. As to the issue in terms of the lack of telecommunications competition, I would say you can lay squarely at the feet of the Public Utility Commission. They have had a proceeding open for 6 years on universal service, which is a barrier to entry. The fact that we don't have a universal service plan for competition to come to provide residential ratepayers choice. Because today, the way the rates are structured, the cost that that regulated rate companies are delivering telecommunications services is below cost. And that's because we, as a policy, think Oregonians should have reasonable and low-cost telecommunication services. The Universal Service Fund is a mechanism to take that and make sure that in going into the future, Oregonians in all areas have access to affordable and reasonable telecommunications. Great. Now, it's a complex issue. I don't suggest it's just simply as simple as going off and doing it, but I think in terms of there has been a lack of effort by the commission to close out that specific issue, which is an example in terms of where they could have acted and they have not acted. And if they had acted, I contend we would see more companies coming in and competing in the residential marketplace, giving each of our constituents the opportunity of choice. And because right now the competitors that are in the marketplace competing in the telecommunication industry are competing for business lines. And that's because those rates are higher and they are above cost, and so that there is an opportunity for competitors to make a profit. There is not an opportunity today for competitors to make a profit delivering residential telecommunication services. And so that's an example of that. I just received some suggested amendments that I'm going to suggest. The copies are being made. I just received it this morning from Legislative Council. And what this does, Mr. Chair, is it moves the suggested is to move the PUC staff not to the DCDS, but to the Economic Development Department, make some specific changes puts into statute some specific requirements that we look to the economic well-being of Oregonians as well as we deal with this. I don't think in terms of where the staff sits and who they report to is going to change their job and their mission and their effectiveness. There's nothing in this bill that reduces the staff. It doesn't say that we have less staff in terms of support the mission. But what we have today is we have a three-person commission who we have three bosses for an agency of people, and we all know it's very hard to serve more than one master. And so you have PUC staff answering to three different commissioners, and what this does is simply take, like most agencies, roll them out, have them report to an administrator, and then the commission can then make an independent judgment as to the report, and they act. And there's no other change in statute except for in terms of the recommendations here, that would create an environment that we when recommendations are made to the PUC Commission, that there is an opportunity for us to understand the role that utilities play in making sure that we have healthy delivery systems in gas, electric, and telecommunication services, as well as water. Water is also one of their PUCs.
Okay. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Hurston of Hill. If this bill were passed, would the decisions that the PUC make, would those be made behind closed doors? Would they continue to be made in a public open process, allowed for public input?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, there's nothing in this bill that changes the process in which the Commission acts. I think it brings a little more accountability in terms of the staff process. There's someone to go to. If you disagree with the staff, you can work with staff, and the Commission still has responsibilities under the Oregon Public Meetings Law to conduct their hearings in the open and public, and it doesn't change any of those requirements.
Thank you. Does this bill in any way politicize the PUC more than it is in the
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, no. I think as though what I think this does is it brings back in a clear way understanding that that what they do is that their job is to go and implement the policies, not to go out and create the policies. I think this is a reaction by myself and Representative Butler and our discussions in terms of how the Commission has acted. I'm very clear in that. I think they have acted inappropriately, and this is a reaction to that and a mechanism in terms of the legislature to step forward and say, this has got to change.
Yes.
You hit on this and you testified, Representative Hill. Just to clarify again, the staff issue, there's concerns that if we move the staff from the PUC into the DCVS or OEDD, that somehow that staff wouldn't, or maybe the staff wouldn't even follow, and that we'd lose that PUC staff. And your understanding is that we'd have the same staff, the same expertise, and basically making the same decisions for this, or going through the same process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, sort of the question is kind of confusing because all this simply does is tells the staff to report to a different agency. They're going to sit in the very same desk in the very same place. They're going to do the exact same job they're doing today. It's just simply in terms of a reporting structure, in terms of who they report to, disconnecting the commission from the staff to the extent in terms of from an administrative role. That's all this bill does. And save the amendments that we have, they will it changes a couple of statutes in terms of different issues that they must take into account when making the recommendations to the commission. Other than that, all of their responsibilities are there. It doesn't change any of anything else.
Okay.
Sure.
Representative Beck.
Do you feel that the current PUC members are competent individuals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I think that yes, they are competent.
Okay, I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is how you started talking about it, but maybe you can elaborate more, how this new structure will help us deal with some of these problems. If we've got three competent people, you may disagree with them, I may disagree with them, but we have a structure set up that appoints, governors appoint. We've had three governors now since the three-member PUC. They've been appointed, Senate's approved them. They've all gone through, some of them have gone through reappointments. Three diverse people, different parts of the state. You've acknowledged these are competent individuals. think you've acknowledged is a complex realm of state law and federal law, really, to some extent. How would this new structure help us? Be any different, or how will it help us better resolve these issues, given that we've got three competent people whose Senate have confirmed and reconfirmed? What's broken here? Is it just we disagree with these individuals, so we slap them around, or is this new structure going to fundamentally make decision making process better for the people of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that I think yes, the structure will fundamentally make a specific change in terms of it makes the staff a little bit more independent, so that this is sort of my analyzing staff and my own understanding in terms of human interaction. I don't suggest I'm an expert in it. However, I think that it's very hard to go tell your boss he's wrong. And if you have a set of people, keep in mind, the commission's job is a quasi-judicial body to make a determination on race proceedings and different issues related and responsibility they have. And so if the commission is taking a more activist role in terms of in trying to drive policy rather than make determinations and playing a role in terms of where the legislature sets the policy. But keep in mind that setting rates and these issues is traditionally a legislative responsibility in terms of as these rate cases became more complex, we rolled that out to the executive that from the legislative branch. Here's the policies, here's the rules that we're going to set up. Go make some determination and come up with fair and reasonable rates and make sure that we don't have a monopolistic company infringing upon the monopoly and harming the citizens of Oregon. And so we rolled that out historically. So what they do is a legislative task in terms of setting these things and making these decisions. And so, but when you have staff who answers to them and they're their boss, you don't have an independent recommendation because I believe their recommendations are being tainted by the fact that their boss is telling them, no, I want to see it go this direction. And rather than letting the commission look at the report and make a determination based upon a recommendation of staff, is that, and I think quite simply moving staff out, having a report to another person, it makes a separation there. And the commission can still make the exact same decisions, but I think in terms of you're going to see a change fundamentally in the reports going forward. In terms of, and so the information they're going to get, I think will be different. Others come say, no, everything's going to be the same, but I think in terms of there's a different dynamic there if you're not coming to your boss telling your boss you're wrong.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions?
One of my concerns in making staff more independent is staff is not subject to the public meetings law. So that it seems to me this would encourage more behind the scenes negotiations and discussions rather than that. Have any comment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, I disagree because what goes on today is going on today. It's not an open public process. It's only the meeting of the commission, which is an open public meeting. So those negotiations, those discussions, all take place today, just as you described. But I think in terms of the offshoot of that, in terms of their reports coming forward, you can say that about every agency in what the staff does. I think that there needs to be that discussion. There needs to be that debate in terms of the players and all these things come forward, and that opponents, you know, innocent bystanders all can come forward and talk to staff, have an interaction there, and then they make a report going forward to the commission, and the commission can then say, you know, what's happening here. I don't think it makes it less public. I think because those same discussions and the same interactions go on today, it's just, I think this is simply a reaction in terms of answering to who your boss is.
There's some pretty technical issues that the PUC deals with. Going to unpaid volunteers, do you see any problem in getting five of them? My county commission did exactly the same thing you're talking about here. And in the 10 years they've been at it, they've only had two people run for re-election. They've had a whole bunch of them resign. It's not what they expected it to be when they got in. There's a lot more to it. And it seems like just to be able to respond to a staff report of the magnitude that we're talking here, you're either going to have to get some people with true experience or some people who don't do anything else in life.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not quite as far as saying they have to be volunteers. I think in terms of, yes, they are. I think in terms of the hours they put in, the work they put in, is conducive to paying the commission members. In terms of, I'm not going to suggest this is simply a read an hour of the report the night before and go and make these determinations.
Sending them out of your committee as a full-time job was not a mistake. Okay.
This is a way to meet process and have that discussion there. If we want to pay them more than we pay the governor, I don't know necessarily that's an appropriate.
The staff people make more than the governor. I had one other question. Wouldn't it be easier just to get rid of the three we have now than to go create a new animal? I mean, if the problem is that the three we have now are all of those things that I've heard discussed this morning, wouldn't it be easier just to get new ones? I mean, I don't know who's up next, but there must be at least one of them coming up for Senate confirmation sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Senator Duke, sure. But I think, though, also, in terms of you run the risk of having the same problem. In terms of, and quite frankly, it comes down to this. We have one commissioner with a very strong personality and two weak personalities, and the strong personality wins out. And I don't know how to strengthen the other personality so that we have balance on the commission. And quite frankly, by going from three to five, it's harder to influence two people than it is to influence one person. And these are very important issues that are going forward. They impact the economic well-being of each of our communities and of our state. This is no longer just simply rate making. The technical stuff. We are now getting into deregulation. We're getting into a lot more complex things where there will be winners and there will be losers. And that's where I think it's important that we have more, and you will hear from utilities that someone saying, you really don't know, I go on to five. But I think in terms of, it comes down to this, in terms of, I think each of us understand, as we try to influence the colleagues in each of our chambers, how difficult it is sometimes to get that last person or something. I don't think it should be that easy to sit there and to make these decisions based upon just me badgering one person or cajoling one person into supporting my position. I think that by bringing five, it brings a different dynamic to the commission, and I think in terms of, I think we will have better debate and a better opportunity to make good decisions as these issues will financially impact the state and create economic opportunity for us.
Senator Lem.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about the purpose we're having here. I understand only a 5 minutes to tap. I think it is a very important issue. We need to truly discuss it. It is unfortunate to late use of the time if we have enough time to discuss. And I'm deeply concerned that I hope that somehow, if we are really serious about it, maybe we might be able to form a task force during the interim, and then we can discuss the whole situation. at this time, whether it's our five members or moving to DCDS or OE Economic Development. I don't have any clear picture and why and how we are going to be at this point. I'm just expressing my point of view. My point is not supporting or against it, but the process, the full-blown, the public testimony process has to happen before anything we can move into any decision.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, I believe that's what we're doing right now, is everybody has an opportunity to come and discuss. It was clear to the members of my committee in terms of they understood that this bill was going down to Ways and Means and that we simply ran out of time. It's not a discussion of, we're going to try to move this through without testimony, taking testimony and taking issues, but we do that in this process because we had reached a deadline. It wasn't a deadline that I had set, but I think this is a very important issue. I think it, what is at risk here is the ability to make sure that some fundamental infrastructure pieces are healthy in the state. And I think we are at risk of them not being healthy and at risk our ability in each of our communities to develop and build an economic base that will support our communities in terms of, and I, I point to decisions that the commission made regarding Coos Bay and Northwest Natural Gas and the pipeline, construction of a pipeline. Now, you can sit there and you can look at that issue in the context of rates and what it might have effect on ratepayers and those types of decisions. That's great. You can come up with that conclusion and you feel good about it. But when you step back and you look at what the impact of that is going to be on the state and the lack in that community of not being able to have that infrastructure, it is devastating, and it and that is the balance in terms of making communities healthy or not healthy. And that's why in this in these amendments, if you look on page 2, line 31, adding language that the job is to promote investment in Oregon's energy and telecommunications sector to provide reliable, cost-competitive services for the benefit of all Oregonians. It's a nice policy statement. And then on page 1, lines 18 through 22, the investment by public utilities and telecommunications facilities in the infrastructure necessary to provide the distribution of reliable and cost-effective energy and telecommunications is critical to the economic growth of both rural and urban areas of Oregon. What I'm trying to fundamentally place here is some policy statements coming forth from this legislative assembly to guide the staff, because this is in this amendment, this is in the Economic Development Department. We're creating a public utilities division there. They have all the other responsibilities and rules, and as they go, they have all the expertise, but these changes specifically address their issues so that when they go forward, that maybe it's a paragraph in this in their report, because that's not occurring today. There's not a discussion in terms of what the impact is going to be on the economic impact for Oregonians in terms of, because it's all focused in terms of rates and ratepayers. And to me, I argue that is a short-term discussion in terms of we're talking about pocketbook issues which are going to matter to us tomorrow, but 10 years from now, we can all look back and say, great, we had, we saved a couple pennies on our electric bill, but, at what cost? Do we not build infrastructure in Coos Bay and give a community an opportunity to rebuild? And that's where I sort of say, I think in terms of, that's the kind of discussion that I'm trying to create here. It's not, I don't feel this is destructive. I think this is constructive in terms of fundamentally changing how we approach these decisions. And these are technical changes in terms of who reports to who, but I think they can have a fundamental difference in terms of the decisions that come out of the process at the end, and I think they will benefit all Oregonians.
Thank you. Senator Yee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hill, you mentioned that gas line infrastructure was not allowed in Coos Bay. Can you tell me what was DSE's reasoning
Mr. Chair, Senator Lee, I don't know the specifics in terms of the denied the ability for the company to recover and rate the investment of the gas line to Tuesday.
Then what was their reason?
I don't know.
Well, but I thought you say it's inappropriate. If it's inappropriate, what was the reason that caused you to believe it's inappropriate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I believe their focus was on the impact on ratepayers, and they didn't feel it was an investment that the company should make and be able to recover from ratepayers.
Oh, another question?
Yes.
So that means the rates were low then. If they were not allowed to recover investment, the rates would be low and the clients should be satisfied. The users should be satisfied.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, yes, in those areas where they have service, but into the community of Goose Bay, the action of the PUC leaves them without gas service and the ability to attract investment and effectively change their economic future. And so by that decision, where if you look at it and you focus on short-term discussion, that yeah, that was a really good idea because it kept rates low, but long-term, it has a tremendous impact on the ability of this state to attract investment and attract economic development. And that's where I'm saying in terms of where I'm not suggesting that we swing the pendulum all the other direction and ratepayers bear the cost of all these investments. But I think there needs to be a balance here so that we're looking at those issues and that those are issues that are taken into consideration when we set rates, to understand that if we do not have a healthy infrastructure, we risk our economic future.
Okay. Senator Diggs.
Sure. As I recall the Cruz Bay issue, and I only paid attention to it because the same company was looking at locating in my district, it related to a specific corporation that wanted to come in. After several years of negotiation, they still have not signed an agreement. They they've now managed to, folks in Cruz Bay have now managed to convince Bonneville to pay for transmission lines, which will affect all of our utility bills. There has the potential to do that. But it's a tough company to negotiate with, and again, it's that the company would prefer not to make the investment. They would prefer that Oregonians make the investment, and this was one more piece of that, that while the natural gas line has the potential to benefit the rest of Coos Bay, which is a small community. The reason for bringing it in at the time was for one company, and that's something that, generally speaking, as a policy, we don't spread out to the customers of the entire state. And in this case, we would have done that. So I think it's a little different situation here, and I have not heard the utility yelling and screaming about that decision. Now, maybe they did, and I just missed that one, but I have not. The community that wants the company and wants the great-paying jobs is very upset. But again, I negotiated with this company there. After several years of negotiations, they're still not signed.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree with you. And I'm just suggesting that's an example in terms of the decisions in terms of that are made, that you look in terms of from what are the benefits there, and this ensures that those are part of the discussion, and I'm suggesting they weren't part of the discussion. And I don't know if this is that would change. I think it might in terms of, and it's kind of the chicken and the egg. If you don't have the infrastructure there to support the company, then why would anyone locate there? I mean, and I think in terms of this is, it comes down to a fundamental, are we going to have a healthy transmission system in this state or not? And I think this brings some focus back to that and puts that in balance with rates so that we as Oregonians understand that there has to be an equilibrium. And I'm happy with equilibrium, but I think we are out of balance here, and we are simply focusing on the short-term rates issues, which, you know, are nice pocketbook issues, but long term will cost us far more than if we have a little bit more balanced approach.
An interesting debate is, I think that it's an issue of what we're willing to do to get business to come. When I first sat down with that company to discuss the stuff, they said that when they went to build their plant in Arkansas, Governor Clinton called a special session of the legislature to get rid of the sales taxes completely for them. And that was what they expected, an equivalent thing here. We explained to them quickly at that time. We didn't expect Governor Roberts to call a special session to get rid of income taxes and property taxes for them. And they were really surprised. I mean, they came in with the notion that we're going to be here and we're bringing good jobs, and therefore you ought to be willing to do all of this investment for us. And it is a different perspective. I disagreed with them. They're still negotiating, and we'll see.
Okay, thank you.
Just briefly, yeah. On the discussion in terms of utilities and their fear of the commission, I've had explicit conversations with utilities in the state, and they are fearful. They are fearful of retribution of this commission if they come forward and criticize the decision-making that is made there. It is real. I encourage you to go and talk with them. And I think that's also part of this process, which drives me to this: why do we have such a system that they are literally that fearful? When you have companies, because these are publicly traded companies, they affect their rate of return, which affects their ability to attract capital in the market and get a return. And I think we as legislators and policymakers need to understand that and put that in balance as we go forward in this too, because, again, my message, if we don't have a healthy transmission system, we're going to be focused solely on rates in the short term, then we're going to lose in the long term.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're lacking a quorum, so we will not go to the work session, but we'll hand this over to be dealt with at a later date. I would like to indicate something in the back row in the PUC. I know it's frustrating for you to come before the committee, but I think as one of the members protested to one of the public utility commissioners, when a member is speaking, regardless whether you agree with them or not, you don't have to sit and shake your head and nod in conjunction and disagree with the person speaking. There is a time and place to speak, conduct yourself, but we all disagree with each other, we all agree with each other, but we don't have to make a public issue out of it. And so I would ask that you consider showing the same respect to the committee members or a member of the legislature that we would in turn show to you and give you equal respect. So I don't say that in a negative way, I just say we're all in this boat together. We're trying to find the best way to address the issue. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3615 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 483. Dallas, do you want to explain a little bit about the bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 483. Senate Bill 483 establishes a Smart City and Advanced Community Information Systems Fund within the energy, Office of Energy. And it allocates $2 million from the Economic Development Fund, Lottery Fund, to the city fund, also provides expenditure limitations for the 1999 Office on biennial. It was referred to the Senate Transportation Committee with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senate Transportation Committee passed it out with a due-pass recommendation. We are passing around right now the fiscal impact, along with some proposed amendments, Dash 1 amendments to the bill. The amendments were not adopted in the bill.
Right, correct.
Senator Chisholm, would you like to go to the witness chamber or sit right here?
I can sit right here
all right.
If you are okay with that, but
that's
I will
fine.
Do my little
testimony, so forgive me if I'm reading. I just want to cover it all. The goal of Senate Bill 483 is to obtain tens of millions of dollars for Oregon from a variety of federal and private sources to develop a smart community information system that can stimulate economic development and improve the quality of life in rural, urban, and suburban communities at a low cost to taxpayers. This smart community system will use new Palm Top computers and new wireless communications services to provide a wide variety of new information services for local residents. An essential service will be a smart jitney dispatching subsystem, which will enable communities of almost any size to develop low-subsidy, door-to-door transportation services for their residents, including the poor, the aged, and those with disabilities. Studies conducted by federal and state agencies have found that the availability of smart jitney services could reduce traffic congestion, gasoline consumption, air pollution, and mobility problems. At a far lower cost than merely adding new lanes to roads and highways or expanding conventional public transit services. The approach would be the federal government has established several public-private partnership programs to find ways to use new technologies to solve critical problems. If Senate Bill 483 is passed from this committee, the Energy Office of the State of Oregon will form a partnership with other public and private organizations under one or more of these federal programs to jointly develop and test a smart jitney community system. This public-private partnership will select an existing multi-purpose online information system like Microsoft's Sidewalk or AT&T's PocketNet or AOL's Digital City to use as a foundation for the smart community system. This will save both time and money. The smart community system will eventually provide a wide variety of wireless information services for local residents, including email, home shopping, telebanking, traffic reports, sports scores, stock quotes, games, and interactive training. Most of the cost of providing these services will be paid by advertisers, and the rest will be paid by subscribers. Smart community information systems will eliminate the need for some vehicle trips and help the state achieve vehicle miles traveled reduction objectives. The smart jitney dispatching subsystem for the public-private partnership will be the anchor application for the smart community system because of its potential to save or earn money for users and to attract funds from public and private organizations. Smart jitneys are privately owned automobiles and vans that are authorized to provide door-to-door transportation for people and parcels in selected travel corridors during selected hours. Smart jitneys use US.Call's instant, real-time, or single-trip carpool, will improve the mobility of those who can't drive or prefer not to drive at a low cost to users, like maybe 30 cents a mile, and to taxpayers. Smart jitneys are designed to complement and supplement conventional transit like bus and rail and ferry, conventional paratransit like taxi and dial-a-ride and shuttles, and conventional ride-sharing like carpools and vanpool services, and to make public transportation systems more cost-effective, particularly in low-density areas and low-mile times. Authorized smart jitney drivers will be able to earn hundreds of dollars each month on their way to and from work or college or other locations by providing door-to-door rides to authorized passengers who want to travel in the same direction. Families that use smart jitneys or improve public transportation services to eliminate the need for a second or a third car will be able to save hundreds of dollars each month. Passengers will be billed and drivers will be paid monthly by the smart community system. Smart jitney services will help the state achieve their vehicle mile travel reduction goals and reduce a variety of transportation, energy, and environmental problems at a low cost to taxpayers. Market research studies show that smart community systems, when fully deployed, could reduce traffic delays by more than 50% in congested areas without other improvements in the transportation infrastructure. Senate Bill 483 will provide $5 million in state funds. That would be $1 million per year for 5 years, which will be used to attract other another $5 to $20 million in federal and private sector funds to develop and test smart jitneys and smart community systems in several sites in Oregon. The Senate Bill 483 Smart Jitney Smart Community Systems will create a wide variety of new business employment, education, travel, and recreational opportunities for residents of rural, small urban, and metropolitan areas, and they will also generate royalties for the state of Oregon and its public-private partners when proprietary Smart Jitney Smart Community software is licensed to cities and counties outside of the state.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? If not, Mr. Robert Binky, you come forward, please.
All right. And Mr. Chair, Bob Denke is my constituent and won a prize or award for this idea and through the Good Government
Cascade
Policy Institute's Good Government Award several years ago, and came to me with this idea, and that is my interest in it. He happens to be my constituent, but I have been very interested in this proposal. Since when did you win this award? When did you do this?
95.
Hey, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bob Benke. I'm a transportation systems consultant. I live and work in Beaverton. I do work throughout the country. A lot of work in California, a lot of work in Hawaii, and some on the East Coast. Since many of you know about the concept already, I won't go into great detail. And so some of the attachments that I have here, only in case I get some hard questions, I wanted to prepare myself. But we have a very serious problem in Oregon, both from a transportation economic development standpoint. And in order to highlight this, I'd like to look at this report card that we have that contains five of the benchmarks on measuring how well the state is progressing against the plan that were developed by the Oregon Progress Board, which is chaired by Governor Kitzhaber. And if you look at these, benchmarks, the first one said what we were trying to do was to limit the amount of traffic congestion we have, and mainly in the urbanized areas. And the governor's committee gave us a rank of S compared to where he hoped we would be today, compared to where we are. And the percentage of Oregonians who commute by means other than a single occupant vehicle, we got a score of D minus. Under VMT traveled objectives, you know, we're trying to reduce the number of vehicle miles traveled per capita, the committee gave it a score of an S. And then the percentage of Oregonians outside the Willamette Valley, the percentage of Oregonians employed outside the Willamette Valley, we get an S. And the employment rate of civilian workforce, unemployment rate, we also get an S. And I think the purpose of Senate Bill 483 is there are really four objectives. One is we want to attract the federal and private sector and other outside funds to improve the quality of life in rural, urban, and suburban communities by reducing congestion. This is now a $100 billion a year problem in the United States, and we pay for it in higher prices on cornflakes and gasoline and services and other places. We want to improve the mobility for those who don't have access to automobiles, who can't drive, the disabled. We want to reduce government spending on new roads and new parking garages and other new kinds of facilities. And we want to create a wide variety of new types of jobs. The second page of my handout here includes some of the technology that we're talking about. And that's this picture here. And I've been in the computer business since 1956 when I graduated from college. And in those days, the computer took an entire floor. We then moved back in 1970, so it was an entire room, still air-conditioned and had other those kind of things. And in the 1980s, with the advent of the personal computer, we brought the size down to the desktop. The biggest revolution is yet to come. That is a so-called palm-top computer. This is one made by a Finnish company called Nokia, that used to be in the forest product business, but decided that the money was much greater in high technology than it was in the forest product. And so they now in Finland, I think 60% of all the people in Finland have wireless phones at the present time, highest per capita use in the world. And there's another device called the Palm Pilot that has been very successful. And it's about the size of a pocketbook, you know, a novel a pocketbook that you have. And it has a small antenna on it, wireless, and you can use it to get sports scores, if you're interested in sports scores this morning, stock market quotations, interactive games, and a whole bunch of other things. And in the future, this business is going to be much bigger than the desktop computer, and is going to be much, much bigger than the big mainframe that used to occupy the rooms. Because students will have these type of device. Every student will have it at the high school level 10 or 15 years from now, because it'll enable them to do so many different things, interactive quizzes and a whole bunch of other things. And one of the keys to it is there's a wireless information component that this little antenna here will enable it to, with a very low power device, communicate to relay stations that are very close. And Palm Pilot has announced one of these communication services starts at $9.99 a month. And that's on this little handout. And they have announced a bunch of services. The problem with the industry is they've described it, like one of our previous testifiers this morning said, it's been kind of described as a solution looking for a problem. A lot of people don't want to invest a lot of money in this device because there's not enough stuff on it yet to do. And people don't want to buy the units, and people don't want to develop things because there's not enough units out there. What we're hoping to do with the funds that we're talking about for Senate Bill 483 is to prime the pump on an application that will enable people who have these units to make a lot more than the cost. You know, the costs are going to be $15 or $20 a month, including the price of the unit. We hope that they can earn a couple of $100 a month or save a couple of $100 a month. In order to show you how this would work, let's go to the next slide and or the next handout here. And there are two parts to it. The first part is a part of an obituary from the New York Times that talks about an experiment down in Silicon Valley in Santa Clara County, where they developed a system 25 years ago to provide door-to-door service with little minibuses and connecting to big buses, and they wanted to provide door-to-door services anywhere in the county. And the obituary from the New York Times says it failed because it attracted too many riders. A transit system failed because it attracted too many riders. The problem was, when you start providing door-to-door services, the subsidy levels get up on the order of $10 a one-way trip. And if you budgeted for 1,000 riders a day, and 2,000 riders want to use the system, and there's no economies of scale, you go broke. And that's exactly what happened. And they looked at the problem that they had in San Jose, and they said, we just can't afford to go to this kind of a system. We just can't afford to do it. Germany was very interested in the technology. Like the United States, most of its growth in new businesses and new residences has been in rural areas. Not in the city areas that have very good transit. It's been in the suburbs and the rural areas. And they looked at the San Jose system and a number of other systems, and they made some improvements in the system. And I did a study for TriNet and for the U.S. Department of Transportation when I went over to Germany and looked and evaluated the system in the 1980s. And what they did in a couple of test communities, a town called Friedrichshafen, which is somewhat smaller than Medford, smaller than Ontario, and they put these kiosks around in low-density bus stops all around at the railroad stations and all throughout the community. In order to use the system, you have a little plastic credit card that activated the system. They numbered all the bus stops. You walked up to one of the kiosks, and you put a little card in the system. And then the display would come on, or a voice would say, enter your destination code. And all the bus stops were numbered. So if you were this woman here taking a ride to the bakery, and she wanted to go to bus stop number 23, she would enter the number 23. And then it would say, how many people are traveling together? And the answer in this case would be one, and says, do you have any special needs? Do you have a seeing eye dog, a wheelchair, or any special condition? And that information would be transmitted over a wired telephone line in Germany's case, and a computer would go through a process and say, it's best to do this by one of our fixed route buses where the driver's salary is already paid and the bus is on the road. Would it be better to do this by a minibus that has flexible routing and has some kind of an expensive $10,000 computer terminal located in the vehicle that can route the people dynamically like we do in a lot of elderly and handicapped transportation services in the United States? Or should we use one of our microbuses, a privately owned taxi, to pick the person up. And when you go there to Friedrichshafen or to Wunstorf, you wouldn't know what was going to pick you up. If there was a high school soccer game going on, the chances of getting a big bus were pretty slim. You know, and the average waiting time was 5 minutes. The maximum waiting time was 12 minutes. And the ridership increased dramatically when they put these systems in. And although the cost did not increase as dramatically as they did in San Jose and Santa Clara County, they were still too expensive. And so in Germany, they phased out this demonstration project. They tried it again in Australia, and the cost was still too expensive, although it got very high ridership levels. There's a change. This technology allows us to make a change. And that change says, we have this inventory of empty seats that's constantly moving around our communities in private automobiles and vans. And if we can find a way to match would-be riders with this inventory of empty seats and to compensate the drivers, an instant carpool, if you would, and a telecommunication linked carpool, we would be able to develop a system that would be able to supplement and complement conventional bus, taxi, and shuttle-type services. And this device that we now have gives us the capability to do that. And the federal government has put a very high sponsorship on this program. It's one of their high priority programs in a multi-billion dollar program called Intelligent Transportation Systems. And they recognize big buses and light rail do not make economic sense in low-density communities where most Americans now live and work. And what we have to do is we have to go to more flexible kind of transportation, and we have to use new technologies in order to tap into these things and to make the private sector more part of the solution. And the last slide that I'd really like to talk about, unless I have some questions here, I just want to give you an order of magnitude example of how costly conventional transportation services is unless you do some innovative things. This was a recent report, March, April, 99, that was produced by Arizona Department of Transportation, where they looked through all the spending that was done by major urbanized areas in the United States, and they looked at how much was collected in fares and how much was spent on both capital and operating costs. And although we were not as high in our subsidy levels as Dallas, Texas, we were one of the highest levels in the country. And the fare revenues represented about 9% of the total spending that we had on transportation. This is not only fixed route, but it's also elderly and handicapped. Taxpayer subsidies represented 91%. What I'm saying, if Oregon goes ahead and develops this technology in conjunction with the federal government and in conjunction with the private sector, we will be able to develop a proprietary system that we can license to cities and counties all around the country. We will be able to get share in the royalties of this money. The federal government will match 100% to what the state puts up and what the private sector puts up. So we have an opportunity to get a nest egg, to get a head start on the rest of the country, to gain some revenues as we license this system to the cities and counties, not only in the United States, but in developing countries and other countries around the world. And that's what the goal of this bill is.
Okay. Are there any questions? Senator Yee.
Well, this bill went through a pretty good hearing in the Constitution Committee. But I still have a question, which is, so $5 million, a million a year to get this program started. I can see the initial investment, the public investment to help planning, organization, and get going. Once it's implemented, why does it still need a million a year? After all, if you have good ridership and privately owned vans, it seems to me the system should be able to go on its own rather than continue public investment.
Well, there are a couple of answers to that. Since we last talked, we received a grant to do a demonstration project between Wilsonville and Canby. The Welfare to Work has a special program, multi-million dollar program, to take people. There are a lot of jobs available in Wilsonville. They have more jobs than they have residents. There's a lot of people in communities outside of Wilsonville that want to get to those jobs, But even if they get trained for these entry-level jobs, there's no transportation to take them there. So we put in a proposal. The problem we have right now is these devices are still at the introductory stage right now. They're just coming off the line. So the service at the present time may cost $40 or $50 a month, even though 5 years from now or 10 years from now, it will be down to $10 a month. And so what we need to do is we have to test this thing out, this concept out, in a rural area, in a small urban area, in an inner city area. And if you look at the sponsors of the bill, you find we have a range of conservatives to liberals. We have a range of inner city folks to rural folks. It's a cover the whole spectrum. And what we want to do is we would like to get Oregon to have a leadership role to be able to take the federal funds that are available from the Department of Transportation and Commerce and Energy and Defense and a number of other places that funds are available for this thing and to try it out in a number of different test sites. We'll have to pay a premium for the first couple of years. But what we're talking about, I believe that if we develop the system and it works like the Department of Defense projections say it's going to work, we will be able to generate millions and millions of dollars a year back to the state of Oregon that can be used for a wide variety of other applications.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So how many demonstration projects are you going to have in how many small, medium-sized, and large cities do you have?
Initially, we were thinking of four. And this would enable us to get four different manufacturers, for example. It could be an Intel, it could be a Mentor Graphics, it could be a Motorola, it could be a Nokia. I met with the folks from Nokia, and they seemed very interested in participating as soon as the state has the funding available to try and participate in something like this. And so we're looking, in my mind, and discussing this with the Oregon Office of Energy, I would love to see a suburb-to-suburb type application. We're trying that really can't do a very good job in Representative Beck's area. Some of the local newspapers have pointed out in the West Hills, it's almost impossible to provide good transportation services with big buses. So I would like to see a suburb-to-suburb where the densities and the travel densities are such that big buses don't make sense. I would love to see a small urban area, a Burns, a Ontario, a Bend, excuse me, an Albany, sorry, Albany. Thank you, sir. An Albany, right. I would like to see also an inner city application out to a Wilsonville type test site because you have a lot of jobs there, entry level type jobs, and inadequate ways to get there with conventional public transportation. And I would like to see a corridor like from Eugene over to Florence. There's a rural a road, or from Bend down to Grants Pass, Bend to Thomas Falls, where you have cars going down there and empty seats going down all the time, inadequate transportation services that could be used for this kind of thing, to get to hospitals, to get to jobs, to get to all sorts of different types of sites. So basically we're looking at four. We possibly could do five or six, but depending upon how the federal money comes in. But that would be the ideal to do it.
Okay, thank you. Senator Duke.
I was looking at the amendment. And I was curious, on the second page it says that we're going to contract with an Oregon corporation having personnel with at least 10 years experience analyzing and designing advanced community information services, including smart jitney dispatching and management systems for the design, development, operations, and maintenance of smart jitney dispatching software. Who would that company be?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask for that.
That
this is my amendment. And the reason that I am actually placing this amendment, that could very possibly be Mr. Benke. And I'm not sure that there are. And the reason that I've offered this amendment is I believe we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Mr. Benke has a license on... and a patent on the software. He's willing to give 50% of the royalties to Oregon. And I added this portion of the amendment to be sure that he had a good shot at being able to do this for Oregon. So
Whether there are others, I don't know whether Mr. Benke knows there are others, because he might know the field better, but I presume there are other people doing similar things that haven't been implemented, certainly writing software.
There are quite a few other people nationally who are the same, have a good kind of background. I don't know of any of them that are based in Oregon, but I think it would be a very easy matter for them to set up an Oregon corporation to do this. And, you know, part of the other part of the amendment, including that one, was that I think there was some concern in talking with some of the members of the House and the members of the Senate that said, when we talk about it as a smart community system, it looked like somebody could come in and it wouldn't be tied with the smart jitney application. And part of the amendments were to focus on the smart jitney as the Oregon side of that application. But I think there could be, I would say there's probably 20 or 25 people who would be qualified if they want to set up an operation in Oregon to participate in something like this.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? Senator Lem?
So where are the $5 million coming from?
$2 million, not $5 million. But we'll get into that in work session.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, could we have a budget, how you can spend the $2 million, so we can have an idea how much goes into planning, organization, maybe?
Senator, that's probably inappropriate at this time because it has to pass the Legislative Assembly and signed into law before you can develop a budget.
It is the Department of Energy.
And it'll be the
Mr.
Department.
Benke can't answer that.
The Department of Energy will set forth the criteria. Mr. Benke is only going to apply to do business with the state. So it's really up to the Department of Energy.
Well, I just like some general information. How much is spent in planning organizations? Maybe how much is used for...
You're free to ask that of the Department of Energy, Mr. Graney and Sharon. And Ms. Graney, if you could provide that in writing to Senator Yee, because we need to move on with this bill. There's other people here for another bill.
And a copy to the committee.
Okay. Representative Best?
A quick question or statement. I guess one concern I have is we've got a senior disabled transportation problem, and often it's the senior people who, for whatever reason, don't become technologically adept. And I'm wondering whether part of your program would be to train, and this is this population that needs the service, it's the least likely to use these phones and get comfy with it. And if you're really going to serve that population, how is this money going to help train people to get as comfortable with this as they are with their telephone?
Yeah, that's a good question. Two issues. I have been working for the Department, U.S. Department of Transportation, and the state of California, the state of Hawaii, and a number of other people. We have already done all of the planning, I think, that's really necessary on how this concept would work. And these are available in public documents from a variety of different sources, state and federal sources. So I don't anticipate, you know, that there would be a great deal of work would have to be done in that area. If you look at that little handheld computer that I have a picture of in the diagram there, it had no keyboard. There are going to be a couple of different kind of models. This one here has a little keyboard, and if you have small pointy fingers, you can give you a speed typist. But most of the other ones don't have any keyboard, and they have a little menu on there. And what I would envision that it will be much more user friendly. So just the same way that this woman in Germany is pressing the button on the kiosk, they would be able to have essentially a kiosk in their pocket or purse and be able to do this stuff, and it's a very easy way to do it. But there would also be a provision that they could call up by telephone. And if a person wanted to arrange a ride by telephone and were properly able to do it, there would be essentially a help desk, and there might be a slightly higher cost for that because it's an operator-assisted call. But there will be... We'll be able to do it either way, either by telephone or by this palm-top computer. The palm-top computer would be a little cheaper.
Okay. Is there any other questions? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 483 and open the work session on Senate Bill 483. Dallas.
You have before you the fiscal impact
The question was raised where the funds would come from. As the bill was drafted, they would be from the Economic Development Fund. These would be lottery funds that would be transferred to this fund. The $5 million is over 5 years. This bill for life expenditure limitations for the upcoming biennium. So it would require one program technician, one FTE for the biennium, and the 01-03 biennium, and again the funds for 01 or 03 would be limited to the $1 million per year. So there the bill is drafted, the allocation would be $1 million per year from the Economic Development Fund to this fund.
Okay, Senator Duke.
Mr. Benke said that they just got somebody just got a federal grant. I don't know if that's the Department of Energy. He's nodding, yes. How does that fit in with this? I mean, does that...
Richard Rady, if we're making about 30 seconds, we got another bill.
The program because of the federal grant?
Because you can talk real fast.
Mr. Chairman, there's Mike Rainey from the Office of Energy. This is a grant requested jointly with ODOT. It requires matching money, as most of these federal grants do. So if this bill were passed, this would allow us to use this money to match federal grants like that. And it was for, I think, only $150,000.
Does this allow us to expand the program even more? Or?
Well, we just received that grant, so we don't have a program up yet. But yes, this would allow us to receive that money because a match is required.
$150,000.
I believe that's
the RMM.
Yes, from the federal government.
From
the
federal.
So we can have a match that is dollar to dollar there.
Well, if you provide as much as Senate Bill 43 provides, that would allow us to pursue these other federal funding sources as well that have a similar matching requirement, up to that, say, $1 million a year, if that's what you provided.
Okay, is there further questions? We're in the work session. Remind everybody, Senator Qtub now moves that we amend Senate Bill 483 with the dash one amendments dated
3/1/99. I do, Mr. Chair.
Can I ask one question?
Senator
Duke. How big a project is this, assuming we get the federal money? I guess I was thinking we were investing $2 million and this was a pilot and all of that, but you're saying we could get as much money from the feds as we're putting in, so it could become a $2 million a year? Is that?
Mr. Benke.
Chairman, Senator Duke, the way the U.S. Department of Transportation, they have a number of different pots of money for different kinds of projects. This one happens to be for welfare to work, and the maximum amount that a city decides the Wilsonville and Canby could get was $150,000. And there are other projects, for example, sustainable communities. There's another one for elderly and handicapped and other kinds of projects. And in answer to Senator Lim's question, less than $150,000 of the funds that you vote, as the legislature votes to approve this, would be used for matching funds on this one project. This would be a preliminary part of one of the projects. It would not be a fully automated system of the type we're envisioning in the future.
So you believe we have a potential to have more than $2 million a year available for these pilots?
From the federal government?
But combined, federal, because it's a million from the state, and if you're getting better than one-to-one match from the feds, so you have the potential to have more than $2 million a year in this pilot?
That's correct. That is correct. Not necessarily the Wilsonville Canby one.
Oh, it's Albany at that rate.
It's four or five projects around.
All right. I need to cut you off, but we can either talk the bill to death or we can try to take some work action on it. The motion is to amend Senate Bill 483 with the dash one amendment. It is 3/1/99. Is there further discussion? Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't get the full information I asked for. So this is a condition, yes, based on all the information I asked for.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let the record show, okay. The motion passes. Dallas, is there any more we have to do on the bill?
We have to move to the full committee.
We have to move to the full committee.
When does it go to the full committee?
I don't think it'll be there Friday, will it?
Probably not.
We could try to get it there by Friday, but
Representative, I've got a
question about public. Is this service exempted from public contracting statutes? Is that addressed in the bill?
I can answer. It's the same with any public contracting. They have to be subject to applications review, and the Attorney General has a form that.
And we've given them the criteria, obviously.
The intent here is to
it's not to circumvent that.
Right. No. Right.
All right.
I have one question.
Senator Lim.
And then, is this a pilot program?
This is a pilot program.
Just 5 years or 2 years?
We can only commit on
We can only budget it 2 years at a time. But the intent is, if it's successful, we come back in subsequent legislative sessions and continue its effort. If not, we can always revisit it.
One more quick question. I heard a testimony that the Germany and Europe, other places, they all failed. What guarantee we have that we are going to continue to proceed in the future? Just I was spending $2 million not knowing whether it's going to succeed or not. Because I don't believe, unless it is a completely privatized their own, continually public money going in, but I don't believe it is whether it's going to work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, they failed because they don't have the same electronic systems that we have. Our technology has advanced to a point where we believe that this can run because of technological advancement. That's number one. But number two, remember, right now we have public transit systems that we keep, if you're talking about money being spent, we continually subsidize our transit right now. This will help us to have other opportunities and have less subsidized public transit, and it really will alleviate a lot of the congestion. It will help senior and disabled. I believe that will be one of the populations that will really have the advantage of this bill, as well as communities that are growing so quickly that we can't have more capacity in lanes. So it is basically the technology and the partnership with the private sector as well that I think that we can do this better. Those others were all publicly run, and they basically had so many riders they couldn't continue to run it. So it took more money to run it. This way, because of the technology, we're going to fill empty seats that already exist and are going to school and work and all kinds of things.
Okay. The motion before it is Senator Cheekub
has moved Senate Bill 483 as amended to the full committee with a detailed recommendation.
With the LFO recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Is there further discussion? Representative Beck.
I co-sponsored this bill. I think it's one of the few bills I've had a chance to co-sponsor with Senator Cheekub. I am going to oppose the motion today. We're looking at a proposal here for senior and disabled that does not fund senior and disabled transit in our major budget, and I think we've got to take care of our base needs before we start getting involved with experiments. I think this is a great idea, it's an innovative idea, and I think it's an idea whose time has come and will certainly improve as technology improves, but I still think we've got to first deal with our base needs, because I think it's going to take some time for this program to gain the success and currency in society that it needs. So I'm going to be voting no today. Maybe by the time this bill gets to the floor, it'll be clear that some of our base needs will be taken care of in senior and disabled transit. So, but I'm going to vote no today.
I would like to respond that, be it far from being concluded, the ODOT budget, the issue of senior disabled has not yet been resolved. It'll be up to this committee to resolve that. The indication has been given to me, and it's not for public record, but we're working on trying to find a solution. And I would point out that if we wait on everything, waiting a final would be here year-round because we'd be afraid to make the next move. So for that reason, since I want to go home one of these days and see my family and have visitation rights, and not live within 40 miles of Salem, I would move that we adopt this, get it on its way, and let's go home.
Yeah.
Senator Duke, you know what an Astoria.
No, I have a procedural question. Somebody said something about and the LFO recommendations, and I've never done a procedural bill in that, and I mean a substantive bill in ways and means, so I don't have an LFO recommendation.
LFO recommendation is right here in front of you.
Oh, okay. I see the fiscal sheet. I didn't see any recommendations. I guess that was just a procedural.
The recommendation was to include the $2 million expenditure limitation and where the money was coming
okay,
from.
Okay, and the FTE.
And one FTE.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Terry.
Does he need to include federal money expenditure limitation?
No. They'll come back to the board to get that expenditure limitation if necessary.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Okay, one final question.
Senator Lim.
I know time is running out, but the $2 million coming from the lottery money?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
And that we are struggling to solve all the problems. Do you think we can get the money out of that?
This has been approved by the leadership.
We know we can, Senator Lamb.
It's been approved by the leadership and the co-chair.
And it's my bill, Senator Lamb.
Okay, clerk will call the roll.
I'm going to give a courtesy yes or this one, but
okay.
I need more information in the future.
Okay.
Well, yes,
I'll give it to you.
For you.
Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Me? This is a condition yes, subject to it.
Lynn?
Aye.
Hugh?
Aye.
Max?
Courageous no. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Mr. Chair?
Aye.
Motion passed. Senator Chutak, would you share this before the full Ways and Means? Senator Chutak, would you share this before the full Ways and Means in the Senate and the House? Would there be a prayer in the House? Representative Trader?
Sure.
Okay. And we'll close the work session of Senate Bill 483. And if I can remind my Senate colleagues, we have one more bill to have a public hearing and work session on this morning. There's people here who have come from a distance to testify and participate on this bill, so I'd ask you to please bear with us for a few moments as we have a hearing and work session on this bill. We'll open the hearing on House Bill 3141. John, would you like to give us some comments, please?
Thank you, Senator. I have three handouts for the committee this morning. First of all, we've got a staff measure summary and the last one. I have also a fiscal impact statement prepared by our office. And with respect to the fiscal impact statement, the total amount as far as expenditures, total expenditures is $903,500 on the fiscal impact statement that I handed out. The Employment Department has modified that somewhat, mainly in the split between personal services and services and supplies. Personal services should be about $727,000, and services and supplies should be about $177,000, roughly. The overall impact has not changed significantly. It's about $903,827 instead of
$903,500.
Yes, ma'am, I surely will, Senator Duke. The personal services amount for 9901 should be 727084. Services and supplies 176743. Total 903827. The last handout that I have for you is from the Employment Department. My expectation is that they will want to go over it with you. This is, in simple terms, what the bill would do. It talks about potential revenue sources to take care of the expense related to implementing the bill, an explanation of the fiscal impact, and how the agency would accommodate the fiscal impact if additional revenue sources are not available. So with that, I would turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions prior to opening it up for public testimony? Mr. Phillips, are you the main sponsor of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Are you running on a tight timeline, Mr. Chair? But for the record, my name is Paul Phillips. I represent Nike. I have Gary Odegaard here in the audience today, who is the U.S. tax manager of Nike. 3141 passed the House, 53-1. It's a policy change that we believe reflects fairness. We know of no known opposition. AOI has authorized me to say that they too support the bill. The issue is how to fund it, essentially very quickly. The fairness factor is we want to keep businesses that change their corporate structure to keep their earned unemployment compensation rate. That's the issue. 43 other states do it. The policy changes that people have signed off on now for funding, they've recommended three different options that they'll run through with you, that all three are to consider. But we believe that since the maintaining a good rating that you earned is good policy, that this bill should be moved forward to the full committee. And we'll stand ready with Gary or myself to answer any questions, but we appreciate the hearing today.
Okay. Are there questions of committee members? Representative Schrader.
Probably the bigger corporations will be taking advantage of this. Is there any of the free funding options, CUS, or those that be taking advantage of it, will probably be the ones most likely to pay for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, actually what we found out, Mr. Representative Schrader, that mostly these are smaller corporations that would take advantage of this. They estimated perhaps up to 100 a month. While Nike came forward with the bill, we found several businesses within the legislature or the people owned within the legislature that this exact same thing has happened to them. So it's across the board. The options of freezing employment or going after grants or delaying the credit process to January 2002, those are the three options as we understand, and that explained to me. Obviously we wouldn't, if we could implement the bill without moving the credit process out to 2002, that would be our preferred preference, but that does cause some issues within the department.
Hey, are there other questions? If not, thank you, and if you'd step aside, we'll have Verlina Crosley, Department of Employment. The Senate members are probably going to be subject to call pretty quick, so I would recommend that we try to move through this as rapidly as possible. So welcome to the committee, Verlina, and if you'd continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Verlina Crosley, the Director for Employment Department. You heard just a little bit about what the bill does. It allows companies who are have a particular rating, generally a better rating, to identify a portion of that corporation, for example, that breaks off and becomes a new company. Current law means that they have to establish a new experience rating, which until they do, we put them at a 3% rating. Often, in many cases, that's around 1% if they were going to keep that rating, and that enhances the discussion. Under the bill, new corporations or new portions of the businesses would be allowed to optionally request prior claims experience in determining their new rates going forward. There's about 42 states that do this, so there's many states that believe this is a good policy. The budget has passed, and there is a fiscal impact. What we did was look at, one, what would the impact be, and I'll go through that in just a second, and then whether there would be additional funds for those particular law changes. Under the potential revenue sources that we looked at, sometimes Department of Labor authorizes new law change funding. actually have checked with our regional office. That appears fairly unlikely this time, but if it becomes available, we could come back into emergency board or something like that to address that. However, we are aware that there are some REDAP funds. If you remember, we talked about those in our budget development and as our budget passed out. That may be coming available to us on October 1, 1999. In the congressional discussions, there is a potential. Sometimes they reduce the administrative funds by that amount, so we don't know whether it will be actually new revenue. If, in fact, however, it is new revenue, and if, in fact, it does come into Oregon, we would need an amendment to the law that would allow us to accept REDAP funds for these purposes. We have in the past only been able to use them, both by federal law as well as state law, for purchases of buildings or equipment, et cetera. This particular distribution would be a new distribution and could be used for staffing, so it could be used for something like this. So we would need an amendment to the bill, or a bill, to allow this to happen. The fiscal impact has two primary portions that affect the employment department. One would be in the area of information systems. This is
Representative Schrader.
What's the third funding option you hit on, two?
Only two.
Okay.
One would be for new change law changes. We don't think that's available, but we think that REDAC potentially could be. In the fiscal impact, we would need information services position. This is a very large change, even though it sounds fairly simple, because we have to experience rate the new businesses and the old businesses, and that's over a three-year period, and there's a retroactivity portions of the bill. My information system and staff tell me that in this particular case of about 6 million lines of code, this changes about 4 million lines of that code. So it is a very big change in the area of information systems. And then the portion that would be the manual process until we got the new system developed, which there is a chart that we have done and sort of shows the time frame of when people would be working on that. It's attached to my handout. The color represents the reprogramming, the interim manual, and retroactivity is the yellow, which would be tax section manual staff, and then there would be an ongoing maintenance of processing these requests. The request is...
Congress,
yes.
Can I ask you, we're getting into in-depth, and this bill's already been heard in the substantive committee. Can we kind of keep it on what your budget is? Are you for it or against it? I guess I want to know. You haven't stated anything yet.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we are neutral on the policy issue, and we are raising the fiscal to this committee's attention.
Okay, but there's nothing to preclude you from coming back to e-board to seek release or expenditure limitation, carry out the provisions of the, or provisions of the bill.
The actual bill, Mr. Chair, is effective in October, and so it would be difficult to get back to the emergency board to get the positions necessary for the programming.
Mr. Chair, could I interject?
Yeah.
And ask the question?
No, that's fine.
Okay. As I understood what you said, Ms. Crosley, you said that you would need an amendment to the bill to be able to accept REED Act funds. And I don't believe that is something that they can get from the emergency board.
That's my understanding.
The position authority and certainly expenditure limitation you could get from the board, is that right? But if REED Act dollars were available, you couldn't get them unless you had an amendment to this bill.
Mr. Chair and Mr.
Do you have an amendment?
We have a draft and can work with staff to work with legislative fiscal to accomplish that.
I would like to see it. Let me ask Mr. Britton, is it crucial that we have this amendment or not?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, from what I understand Ms. Crosley to be saying, one of the revenue sources, and it's more likely than the other UI federal dollars, are the REED Act funds. And if they are available, it would seem to me to make sense to take them to be able to get this work done and not put an extra constraint or burden on the employment department's budget.
But if they don't have the amendment, even if the READ Act dollars were available, they couldn't get it.
What I would like to suggest then is Mr. Phillips, Ms. Housley, John Britton from our staff, work up the amendment here, and we're going to reschedule this for Friday morning for a work session so that everything's in place and ready to go, because it's my understanding that everything was here and ready to go. So, Senator Duke.
I'm not familiar with substantive bills and ways and means. It was my assumption that we were going to be, this was becoming an appropriation bill and we were taking this money out of the general fund. Although it doesn't note any particular types of funding.
Yeah, these are all other funds.
Other
unemployment insurance funds. So they're all identified as other funds.
So we wouldn't, by passing this, we wouldn't be putting any new money in the agency.
Nope.
We would be saying take this
out of your existing agency budget.
Has this been through a substantive committee in the Senate?
Yes.
In the
not in the Senate, in the House.
Yeah, not in the
House. It came out of Business and Consumer Affairs and was referred to.
Okay,
yes, Representative Trader.
Question on when you come back with the amendment, there are several funding options. Are the amendments going to include any of the above? Is that going to be the way they're going to be presented to us, i.e. the READ Act law change and also the date?
I think the READ Act language will probably be the only issue that's going to come back.
That's the only way they're going to go for.
We're not going to reinvent the wheel after it's been through two substantial committees.
And all I would say, Mr. Chair, is that if this UI, do you have authority to use the UI now without, if it fits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kupel, we would have authority to use it if we got
okay.
If you all can meet this morning, go to Legislative Council and get a draft of a proposed amendment to address the READ Act issue, and we will bring this up Friday morning of this week for a public hearing and work session. Okay, is there further questions?
No.
Senator Eve.
So when you take away $8 million from the unemployment insurance fund, does that mean all the other employers have to pay increase their rates to make up for the fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Eve, those would be the amounts that would come out of the trust fund for the credits. But at that amount, it does not look like it would raise the tax rate for the general employer population.
It's probably the best thing to do. Is what is the unemployment account fund? What's the net value?
It's over $1 billion.
$1 billion, and you apply that against $8 million, it doesn't make a pimple.
But I want to make
$800,000.
What is the
impact?
$8 million.
Oh, okay.
But what you're in essence saying is there's no rate increase anticipated.
At the current time, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Is there further discussion? If not, we are adjourned until 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Thank you.